Stand or not to stand? That seems to be the question. But where does education stand on this topic? We will talk to a veteran and a teacher about it. Plus, Alfie Cohn and Matt Damon's mom get personal. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio. Fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From edweek.org, educators are more stressed at work than average people, survey finds. The survey released by the American Federation of Teachers and the advocacy group Badass Teachers Association on Monday included responses from about 5,000 educators. They really need to do a survey about this, Tim? Really?
Well, it's the badass teachers, yeah.
They're badass.
No, but think about this, right? It's stress, and everybody knows that there's workplace stress. And so what's unique about this survey is to really go in and break down as compared to other workplaces, mm-hmm. right? So the idea that teaching is stressful shouldn't be necessarily surprising
to
people.
No, not at all.
Because you're working with kids who've got this issue. You're trying to be working with parents who sometimes might want to do this. I mean, teaching's a stressful job. It's also incredibly rewarding, which is why one of the reasons most people actually go into it, because the rewarding side is usually much better than the, quote, stressful side. What this study gets at, though, is to start pointing out the fact that that move towards more stress than reward should be troubling.
Yeah, that's well. And there was one statement that said, "Treat teaching as a calling and a career." Because I think a lot of my friends that went for teaching were saying, "It's my calling. I'm right. going to be a teacher,
and I'm going to do whatever it takes."
Yeah.
And the problem, even with that, that position is that you can then find yourself in these stressful situations. And as they point out, it's bullying, it's lack mm-hmm. of autonomy, it's the inability to make decisions within their own classroom, all of these things, right? And if you take this to heart, that statement from that teacher, saying you're going to stress yourself out to the point that you can't work anymore. And so to mm-hmm. actually stay in the profession, you have to limit the it's almost like you have to limit the calling part, that passion part.
And know that it's a career, along with what you really want to do, but it's also your career.
But see, and I take that as a good advice, but also an indicator of a really sad statement, because mm-hmm. these are the people who you want to go in there with an idealistic sense of going, this is what I want to do. I have a mission in life to do this.
Right.
Now you're telling them, look, the only way you can survive is by sectioning off the pain.
Right. That's not appropriate. Okay.
So, again, so Badass Teachers, the American Federation mm-hmm. of Teachers puts it out there. It's not surprising stress. What's surprising, though, is how much more stressful teaching is than other work career places. And the fact, though, the tilt towards more stress than reward, we should be worried.
From the La Crosse Tribune, Wisconsin has the largest well-being gap between white and black children, report says. The Race for Results report, prepared by nonprofit the Annie E. Casey Foundation, issued 12 indices to determine the overall well-being of children across the United States based on a composite score of 1,000. Wisconsin had the largest disparity between black and white children, the report said.
Wow. The Wisconsin, number one.
That's not anything we would. Yay, us!
mean. Yeah, this is one of those ones you don't want to brag about. Right?
No, you don't.
Having the largest disparity in the gap, and we'll talk more about the gap. But this actually is for those of us who look at particularly educational attainment, and we talk about the achievement gap between students of color, black students, particularly, and white students in Wisconsin. We know there's a big disparity between standardized test scores, right?
Right.
This goes even deeper, though, and really looks at, quote, what they're saying, well-being gap. You know, and one thing to take away is to say, wow, who knew that so many children live in such poverty-ridden conditions?
Right, because right? you don't talk about it that much.
We don't talk about it that way.
Right.
The other thing, though, and we've said that you can look at this and come back and go, well, of course the well-being of these children is bad or shows a massive gap because, according to the statistics, so many of these children live in one-parent households. They come from households that are in the poverty index. They have a lack of nutrition and things like that. And so it makes sense, sadly, that African-American children in Wisconsin who seem to have more of those types of factors in their lives, that they would have this gap between well-being.
Right, right. Right.
Okay? So you can go, well, but we really need to think hard about this and say, why do those conditions continue to exist generation after generation? Right. Mm-hmm. Some people would say, well, we need to get off your lazy butt, or you need to get off your lazy butt and get to work. Other critics, and I'm more in line with this, would say we've got an issue of generational racism, and the issue of jobs and healthcare and nutrition disproportionately always negatively affects African Americans first.
Time for Tim to rant. This is Someone Has to Say It.
The Gap. Well, we heard about the gap in the news, but look, let's be real. There is so much in that story that points out the realities associated with the gap. However, one that fails to be recognized is the amount of time and resources we waste on demonstrating the achievement gap. We have spent well over $1 trillion, quote, measuring schools and holding them, quote, accountable, only to prove that we have a gap that has persisted for well over 20 years. Why do we continue? Why does accountability still hold power? Well, it's because it works. It works at proving that public schools, poor children, diverse children, and low-income communities are failing. This perpetuates the poor and minority deficit perception and allows for the systematic dismantling of public schools and puts the blames on teachers and children and their families. Hell, in Wisconsin, we have spent $270 million on 2% of the population to attend private schools. Now, 70% of those children were already in private schools. Why? Because accountability keeps failing schools and failing children and the failing teachers narrative alive and actively promotes divestment from our public schools and their communities. Please, let's stop acting like the gap can be closed by spending huge amounts of money on accountability and school choice. These investments work to support each other. Invest in accountability and you prove gaps. Invest in choice and vouchers to fix the gaps. Sorry, it only works if your goal is to make sure the gap persists. I have the data and the historical analysis. Just ask and I'll gladly show it to you. However, that might mean you actually care about our brothers and sisters of color.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
Later in the show, Alfie Cohn will join us in Cohn's Zone. Right now, we will present the question that is the title of one of his many books to Patrick Sullivan, head of Ireland's National Council for Curriculum and Assessment. Patrick, what are the schools our children deserve?
The schools that our children deserve are ones that completely accept them for who they are when they walk through the school gate. So they're not presupposing the types of experiences or the types of people that they're going to become. They are allowing children to grow into their education, and that schools are nurturing each and every child that walks through their school gate and through their classroom doors. It's also an outreaching place into the community, somewhere where families and parents in communities feel very comfortable in coming to. It's a welcoming space, a space where professionals are leading learning with the best interest of every child in the school community at heart and at the heart of every decision made in the school. It has a very strong leadership aspect to it, a leadership that is completely engaged in the needs and the wants of their local community and who do their utmost to meet those needs and those wants of their parent group, of their student body, and of their professionals who are working in the building with them. It's one that respects everybody in the school day, in the school building, not just the teachers, not just the children or the parents, but every member of staff, be it the bus driver, the janitor, and that real meaningful relationships are formed within that school building and environment, and one that makes meaningful difference to students' communities, that ensures that they grow up as well-rounded individuals with a self-awareness and an understanding of the world in which they live.
He did two tours in Vietnam. He received two Bronze Stars and a Purple Heart. And from Madison365.com, he, quote, wants you to know something right off the bat. Protesting injustice, immorality, or any circumstance where the United States is not living up to its creed is the most patriotic thing you can do as an American and is critically important in elevating the voices of the most vulnerable in our nation, end quote. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Will Williams.
Thanks for having me.
That's a hell of a quote, man.
Yes, and I believe it.
There's a lot in there about patriotism, protesting. How does that all fit together?
Well, for one thing, I think what brought it to the forefront was my two arrests at state capitol here in 2011.
I didn't put that in your introduction, right. Your two arrests. I left that out.
No. But, you know, as I was just standing in the capitol, wasn't even singing, and I was arrested, you know, for the freedom I suppose have been fighting for in Vietnam, and I literally shed blood. I got hit in Vietnam. So it was mind-boggling that I would come to this country that I supposed to be fighting for those freedoms and be arrested and manhandling the Capitol, you know, where I was exercising those rights I thought I was fighting for.
Is that the start of making this sense of going, wait a minute, we've got patriotism all wrong?
No, what started that was after Colin Kaepernick came out and took a knee.
Okay.
And when the narrative was changed from what he took the knee for is what made me start sounding off about that case in particular, that he's not doing anything to disrespect veterans or the flag. And I've always felt that this country does not, or the flag, or national anthem is not a real symbol of what this country is about when you look at what's happened throughout history in this country. It's not that shining country on the hill that welcomes all. It's not that country for the home of the brave and the land of free, because in reality, I don't feel that I'm free in America.
So there's a longer history to that, too, that you talked about growing up in Mississippi.
Yes.
As an African-American.
Yes.
What, just a sense.
Well, that's what led me to the military, was to get away from Jim Crow law in Mississippi. And I used the military as a tool to get out. And when I think of that time, and I think of Colin Kaepernick, I also think of Walter Beach, who was a defensive end for the Boston Patriots in 1962, the same year that I went in the military to get away from Jim Crow, and he was protesting the football league because of segregation in Louisiana and other southern states.
Quick fast forward then, or not a fast forward, but a question. So there are other sports figures. Colin Kaepernick is not the first to protest some injustice in America. You gave us one. And there's more throughout history.
Yes, it is. Quite a few. Jackie Robinson didn't feel right singing the anthem. He didn't sing it or standing for the flag. Muhammad Ali. Thomas Smith and John Carlos in the 1968 Olympics, you know, they raised their fists in opposition to what was happening in this country. And it goes on and on. You can even go back to James Baldwin, who often wrote about it. So it's nothing new what Kaepernick did. What's bothering people, he had a platform where he reaches millions of people that see him and hear what he's saying, and the league don't want that to happen.
What is he saying?
He's saying it's time for America to recognize all citizens as citizens, to stop the racism, to stop the police brutality that is always, most of the time, the subjects of it are people of color. And he's asking people to recognize that and do something about it, which is not much to ask.
And that's not disrespecting the flag?
No, okay. It's not. Because the flag, if you are, I'll say the anthem, if you look at the other verses in the anthem, it talks about the slaves and hirelings would have no refuge. So in a sense, that is misleading to what that flag's supposed to symbolize or what the anthem is about. So no, he's doing the right thing.
Well, yeah, you talk about that's okay. You talk about this other thing. You talk about poser patriotism.
Yes.
What's poser patriotism?
To me, it's people that wear the lapel pins that don't really have patriotism. They wear it as a front, and I think even with this Colin Kaepernick thing, it's, to me, they are pretenders. You know, they pretend they are patriotic. In reality, they are not. And they feel that wearing it on a lapel pin is a show of it. And I think that's what happened with the NFL and the thing with Kaepernick. Prior to 2009, the players weren't on the field when the national anthem was played. So after the Pentagon or the Defense Department gave millions of dollars to the NFL, they made it a ritual where they would be on the field and stand with their hand over their heart. And, you know, to me, that's supposed to patriotism. You can't force people to be patriotic. They either are or they are not.
Then you can't force them. Can you teach them?
You can teach them, but I think it goes a lot farther than teaching. I think it's something that people want to do. I think it has to come from the heart of how you feel about the land where you reside, whether you want to put your life on the line to protect it or not.
You did that. You put your life on the line at that time. You were a young man. Did you feel patriotic?
Not in a real sense. I didn't, because I knew at that time that this country was not what it could be. Because as a student, I looked at the Declaration of Independence and that part that say, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, that they had certain unalienable rights among them, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Growing up in Jim Crow, I didn't have that. So I couldn't believe that this country was what, you know, those words meant.
But somehow there was an escape sense, though, by going into the military to get out of the Jim Crow South.
Yes.
All right. And then after Vietnam, you came back to America. And what was it like returning?
Well, coming back in 66, I still didn't understand what protesters were talking about. And I wandered into Haight-Ashbury in uniform. And because of what they were saying, I hadn't adjusted back to this country. And it raised my anger. So I put in a 1049 to go back to Vietnam, because I felt that if I stayed here among the protests, I would be locked up or hurt somebody. So I put in to go back to Vietnam, where I could do what I wanted to do legally.
I want to hold right there. And when we come back to our next segment of Busted Pencils, we're going to get into your second tour of Vietnam and then bring it back to education. So second tour in Vietnam, what happened?
The second tour, I wasn't fighting per se. I was with a military police unit. Didn't have the same level of danger that I had my first tour. While I was at Cam Ranh Bay, there was a race riot there. And it all happened because of a movie that Jim Brown was in, and it had a scene with Raquel Welch. And when people saw that, a lot of the I guess Southerners, soldiers used racial epithets and said it shouldn't have happened. So stuff hit the fan. When I came back from Vietnam, I wanted to learn the real reason why I was even there. So I started reading everything I could about it. Then Daniel Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers. And I read that, and I became angry, you know, with how people were being duped and to believing that we have to go and fight these wars. And children are, I feel, educated to a myth about patriotism in this country, because as a young age, they start teaching them that, you know, you owe this to your government. They start pushing the militarism, and I think it indoctrinate the kids. I have them so messed up that they believe when they become of age that they got to go fight and die for this country, and what in reality is not true.
Is there, I mean, some people would say, but there is a time sometimes, right, to put everything that's out there if the cause is real, or is there not a real cause?
I think the causes today in the modern wars are wars of choice. I think a time that hits me most is the time that Clarence Kalin, who's a dear friend of mine, went and fought for the Abraham Lincoln Brigade as a young man. But when he came back, he was castigated because he was fighting for the right cause. And I say I'll fight today even if at my age, defending these shores. But it's ludicrous to send people all over the world in the guise of fighting to liberate people or protect their protect our freedoms and our interests here, when in reality it's just the opposite. They're wars of choice.
So defending the country is not a problem for Will Williams.
No.
In fact, he will be right there, standing
right
arm in arm. You mentioned children, though, and how we get them to that point. And so being Busted Pencils in an education show will make that hard shift, but because you talked about it. Do schools play an active role in this militarism, do you think, or should they be playing an active role in an anti-militarism state? I mean, if Will Williams could go into the school system and say, here's what I want you to teach children.
Yeah, I think they should do what Howard Zinn wrote that book about, teach the real history
okay.
of America. And children would be able to make decisions for themselves rather than the schools planting it. And I say the schools plant these ideas because many of the administrators or principals or whatever believe in the recruiters coming in and having full access to kids. In 2002, we fought it at the school board meetings where we did get a policy in where the recruiters couldn't roam the hallways and all of that, but it changed.
Hmm.
You know, like I don't feel that school military recruiters should have 100% access to students. Students go to school to learn, not to learn about war or to be lied to about what patriotism mean in order to get them to join the ranks to keep carrying out these wars of choice.
So if we taught patriotism, can we teach patriotism?
I think you can teach young people what it is. They can learn what it is and what it's supposed to be. I'll put it that way, what it's supposed to be. But it's something that they have to have in their heart to do it, to accept it.
What about Colin Kaepernick? Is he teaching us anything about patriotism?
Yes. Yes, he is. He's teaching us that when your country is not the best that it can be, that you should speak out. He's teaching us that we shouldn't believe that it's my country right or wrong. If you're wrong, I'll tell you about it. And, you know, he, as many others throughout history, has done that.
Mm-hmm. So there's truth tellers.
Yes.
You see him as a truth teller.
Yes.
And Will Williams is a truth teller.
Yes.
And Howard Zinn is a truth teller.
Yes.
And you're on Busted Pencils.
Yeah. And I appreciate being here.
Will, is there anything else you want to share with us?
Yep, we're having a program. I'll put a plug in for the program we're having on Veterans Day at the Barrymore Theater. Norm Stockwell and Vets for Peace are putting it together. And it's, you can say it's another way of celebrating Armistice Day, which Veterans Day started out as Armistice Day, and I think it was 1954 when they changed it to Veterans Day, and that was done for a reason. We haven't celebrated peace since Armistice Day became a part of the one of the holidays in this country. And I think it's time people get back to it and look at what that word really means and force our government to start working for that issue, because we can no longer survive in this world by using violence as a means for settling differences. It doesn't make sense.
Well, Will Williams, you are a veteran. You are a veteran for peace. And you are a patriot. And what we say here is thanks for busting pencils.
And thank you.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
He's a social studies teacher in California. He's a social justice advocate. And he writes for Busted Pencils. Welcome to the show, Rebel Teacher.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, so check it out. New post. Why you mad? Taking a knee and white rage in post-racial America. All right, before we even get in it, so you weighed into the NFL controversy over players kneeling for the national anthem. Mm-hmm. Okay, check it out, though, man. You're a social studies teacher. Why are you going to go and mess with the NFL? Don't you have enough social studies stuff to teach?
Yes, sir. But, you know, I think it's important, mainly because I think a lot of the rage is based on a particular interpretation of history. And as a social studies teacher and as a critical educator, I view it as my responsibility to engage the world, you know, beyond just the classroom and just beyond history and apply history to today. So, yeah, I think it's right in my lane to discuss such matters.
Well, so what is it about this situation, though, that you think that people don't understand? The NFL. So I'm a player. Go ahead.
You have to have a nuanced view of history, I think, to really get a hold on what's going on here. But what needs to be understood is the experience of black people in America, that everybody doesn't have the same experience under the flag, number one. The protests in general aren't against the flag, but maybe that should be introduced into the conversation, that everybody doesn't have the same view of the flag. So if you look at American history from an African-American perspective, I think one would have a better handle on why the kneeling is taking place.
Okay. So then back to your classroom. I mean, where does this intersect then in the social studies curriculum?
Well, when we look at the history of African-American, particularly, you know, in relationship to the symbols of America, we don't have the same experiences as, you know, it's not the same as the immigrant experience per se, where this is the land of opportunity and so forth. We were brought here as captives, so it's a completely different narrative that we're even starting from. So, you know, as a social studies teacher, I think it's important to draw those lines and to have that understanding. Also, what's going on in the NFL is filtering down to the high schools. The cheerleaders at my school site actually took a knee, you know, and that's a cue that came right from Colin Kaepernick. When asked why they did it, that's what they brought up in support of Colin Kaepernick and what he's standing for. So, with schools around the country, you know, cheerleaders, ball players are kneeling, and they're getting quite a response from there from administrators and teachers and the community at large.
What kind of response? I mean, so just from your point of view at your school, I mean, what did how was the response from administrators to the cheerleaders taking a knee?
Well, importantly, what was good is no one was suspended, but they were kind of coerced. They were told that there may be some consequences. The captain of the cheerleading team was brought into the principal's office and spoken to. And just even that conversation is intimidating. You know, I was hoping they would continue kneeling, but they didn't kneel anymore after that first week.
So they
were pretty much coerced into not doing it anymore.
So the rebel teacher couldn't convince them through classroom instruction why it's important to, quote, protest.
Well,
I'll put you on the spot, man. I'm sorry on that one.
Well, it's important. Well, they may recognize the importance of protesting, but these are children, you know, and you sit them down in front of adults that have actual power over them, you know, that's a hard thing for them to stand up to.
Lost in all of the debate of stand or not to stand is the reason they are kneeling in the first place.
Inhumane treatment. You know, we've seen many a time the very graphic images of black men being shot down, shot in the back, you know, on the computer screen, on the television. And we see over and over again the culprits are walking, you know, if there's an indictment at all. If there's any question, there's, you know, for the most part, there's not even, the question is not even brought up on whether it was justified or not. It's just something that happened. And then it's just swept under the rug. You know, so they have to bring some attention to the issue. And that's the route they chose to take. And I'm fully in support of it.
What do you say, though, to the person who says, look, you were hired to play football, not protest racial injustice?
I think that's easy to say. For someone who's not the, you know, who hasn't been the victim of racial injustice, what people generally want is they want us to be quiet and shut up. Anything that rocks the boat is going to be frowned upon. When people took to the streets, there was an issue. When they shut down the streets, when they shut down government meetings and city councils, there was a problem with it. Kneeling is the most passive, quiet, and respectful gesture that one could make. So the point is, anything that people do to bring attention to what's going on here, to make a statement, is going to be frowned upon simply because their view of history is not accurate. They see black people as somehow being the recipients of, you know, some type of graciousness from the United States.
I've heard some people criticizing some of the football players of going, you know, look, you're paid, you know, millions and millions of dollars. You know, you should be happy you're in that position.
If we go back to the roots of America, if we take it back to the slave plantation, you'll see the same attitude where there's this hierarchy of slaves. And those at the top of the hierarchy who were able to eat the master's food, wear his old and discarded clothes, this was the class that was depended upon. This was the trusted class. These were the people that they can depend on to snitch, you know, if there was some trouble going on, if some folks were planning on rebelling. So if we fast forward today, this is the same thing. This is the trusted class. These were the people that were let into the club. Mm-hmm. These are the people that we're supposed to be able to trust. These are the people that we don't mind our children looking up to. But
as soon as they step out of line and start calling attention to other issues, then we want them to just be happy with the position that has been bestowed upon them, which is
football player, not not activist.
Anything else is ungrateful.
Right. Everything else is ungrateful. So when you're teaching about this, do other teachers ask you, like, yo, Rebel, man, how do you wade into this? Do you ever catch flack? How do you deal with flack? I mean, if I'm going to be a social justice advocate, a critical history teacher, and I'm learning from the Rebel, I mean, what is the lesson?
Man, I've gone through quite a bit. I've actually been, you know, I started out as a young teacher not knowing how political the school is, the school site is. And, man, I had some problems. And I was actually run out of a district for it. And, you know, you have to be smart. You have to understand that you're in a very political environment. And you have to, you know, number one, I'm not in the class to teach kids to rebel. I'm in the class trying to give them a well-rounded view of history.
Mm-hmm.
And if they do that and take it upon themselves to take steps to rebel, I simply applaud it.
Okay.
But I'm not in class trying to teach children to, you know, to be rebels. My number one thing is to teach them to be have a well-rounded understanding of history. And what comes out of that, let it be. Because in generally, I don't think students have been exposed to a truly objective history.
Well, so let's put it this way. You are teaching children how to bust pencils.
That's right. I'll take that one.
Rebel teacher, man, always good talking to you, man. We will speak again soon.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
Time for another edition of Cone Zone with education guru Alfie Cone. Personal or personalized education? Take it away, Alfie.
There's a big difference between personal and personalized, just like there's a difference between, sentiment and sentimentality. These are not the same thing. It's when it's not personal in any meaningful sense that you have to buy some device or bit of software that creates this artificial personalization. Personal learning means you work with each kid to create projects of discovery that reflect the kid's unique needs and interests. That requires the presence of a caring teacher who knows each student. Personalized learning means you adjust the difficulty level of the prefabricated skills-based exercises, usually based on the kid's test scores, and that requires software. See the difference?
Yeah, well, but I don't know if you saw it was out 2 days ago in the Telegraph by Henry Bodkin, and this put this in, but it's the title, and it's in their science section, Inspirational Robots, Replacing Teachers Within 10 Years, and of course this is coming from Sir Anthony Seldon, the Vice Chancellor at the University of Buckingham.
Well, they've given away the game then. It's just like, how much does Uber care about you drivers, given that most of their profits are being diverted to creating autonomous cars?
Right.
How much does Amazon care about you workers, given that they're working on robots to put you out of work? So this is the end game in education as well, which we're already seeing signs of with these online courses that have horrible results, even using stupid measures like test scores.
So, okay, we're going to leave inspirational robots alone for this point and not move them to the personalized learning. And, but as we talk about that, though, in the teacher education business, I'm wondering if there's a job for a dean of helping program these inspirational robot teachers.
You're already worried about your own job, and you're the president.
Yeah. I'm not the president. I take orders from the president. I still serve at the pleasure of the president.
Yeah, no, I mean the dean. Sorry.
No,
yeah.
I know.
It seems like such an obvious thing to say, and people nod, of course, when I say it, that the question we need to ask is what kind of learning should be taking place in those schools? Ask that first, then ask, is tech useful?
Right.
But it's a radical question because, if I think that there's some forms of technology that can help kids make stuff.
Sure.
Help them create and produce. Yeah, that sounds fine, especially if it's happening collaboratively. But far more common for ed tech is, you know, to tart up a lecture with a smart board,
right,
or look up facts online, or rehearse skills with an adaptive learning system, or, you know, write answers to the teacher's questions and upload them to Google Docs. None of that advances education at all. It just...
Well, it changes. You know, it's like a small change in the medium, and to me, that's it. There's really no, whether it's a whiteboard, a chalkboard, or a smart board. What's
and
the purpose?
And you've got all these educators who are like becoming sexually aroused over this stuff. They can't. They are so excited by anything that is, you know, digital and cutting edge, and uses this stuff, and they're not realizing that this is really all this amazing distraction. It's so much noise that is locking us deeper into an old-fashioned, inadequate model of education. It doesn't, the classroom doesn't become one bit more student-centered because you've got some cutesy software. You've got a, you know, smart board, dumb curriculum, in effect.
Maybe that's the way we should be talking about it, though, just like you just said, is student-centered, because I think a lot of teachers, first glance, when they get jazzed about personalized learning, as you just said, first of all, I think they imagine personal learning. They think it's some form of student-centeredness that has some roots to some kind of Dewey idea. And when I ask them about what's actually happening collaboratively with the students, and they talk about, well, you know, plugging them in, I then ask them to reflect back and say, is that student-centered? Or,
yeah,
you know,
that's right.
You know,
and the answer is usually no, as a result of anything that we're calling personalized learning. In fact, the whole need to personalize probably comes from this transmission model of learning in the first place. You know, if the whole point is to just dump facts into kids, well, then sure, some cute device might help teachers become more efficient at the style and rate of dumping.
Sure,
but if the point is to help them understand ideas from the inside out, then what they're doing is already personal, and it doesn't have to be artificially personalized.
But that's the real key there, is recognizing, do we really want, and this is the question for a long time, not just with digital machines, but any, as you said, a transmission model of education. Which
right.
one are we using? If it's transmission, and if it's an iPad, or if it's a Blackboard, it's the same darn thing.
That's right. That's exactly right. But we're blinded by how much fun some of these devices are.
Alfie really laid out personalized learning. I wonder what Matt Damon's mom thinks about it.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask.
You know, all of this talk about technology and the emphasis on it and all the money put towards it and the idea that you've got to give an iPad to every student in the first grade and keep up with the other school that's doing that. Really, you know, the whole thing is snake oil, because no study, not that personally I don't feel that I need a study to tell me this, but there isn't any study or any research or any evidence anywhere that using any of this technology, iPads or computers, smartphones or any of it, improves the quality of learning for kids. What it does is it distracts people from the deeper, more important, serious issues in education that we have to be thinking about. It makes everybody think if you get these tools, you're going to actually improve education, but it just isn't true. Not that there isn't a place for technology, because I think there is, but it's just been completely overblown and exaggerated in terms of the role that it can have. But sure, there's some situations where you'd have some blended learning that you might choose for a specific situation, a specific student, specific circumstance. For me, it would only be like high school kids, because I wouldn't want to see, I don't like to see any kind of online learning for any younger children. But anytime you do that, though, you're trading off. You might accomplish a certain kind of learning that might have value for a specific situation. But you're also taking away then the opportunity for group learning or for learning in context, collaborative learning. And it gets us to this question of what are schools really for? Because they aren't places just to learn specific skills and concepts They're also places where we learn to get along with other people, to make decisions as a group. We learn citizenship skills that are going to help young people become participating citizens in a democracy when they grow up. The school has a much wider purpose and a role in society and in students and children's lives than just simply getting answers to questions.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
We like to close each show out with a nod to historian and activist Howard Zinn. Here's your moment of Zinn.
If patriotism were defined not as blind obedience to government, not as submissive worship to flags and anthems, but rather as love of one's country, as loyalty to the principles of justice and democracy, then patriotism would require us to disobey our government when it violated those principles.
My thanks to our guests Will Williams, Rebel Teacher, and Patrick Sullivan. Also, our regulars, Matt Damon's mom and Alfie Cohn. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thanks for Busting Pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.